a tense day in Jerusalem. Our reporter was there.
I was actually in my parents' house in Jerusalem visiting them when the air raid sirens went off. We weren't really sure what was going on, and then a few seconds later, we heard a loud explosion.
Also, we've got a plastic waste problem, but there's a global agreement to tackle it.
It will shine the light on the actual flows of plastic waste around the world.
One major world player is not on board, though. And for kids in the U.S. learning English, it's been a tough school year with some lessons for the future.
My hope is that we do not go back to normal, that we actually learn from our experience throughout this year.
And a post-pandemic predicament to hug or not to hug.
I'm a hugger. Yeah.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. This was a scene this morning at the revered Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. At least 300 Palestinians were injured at the mosque, a site referred to by Jews as the Temple Mount. Israeli police say more than 20 officers were also hurt. Later, Palestinian militants in Gaza fired a barrage of rockets at Jerusalem and southern Israel. In response, the Israeli military has carried out airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, with reports of several people killed, including children. We begin our coverage today with the world's Ariel Osaran. You were in Jerusalem, Ariel, earlier today. Now you're back in Tel Aviv. I mean, it's been a long day of violence. What is the latest?
Like you said, it actually began in the morning as violent clashes between Palestinian and Israeli police up near the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the old city of Jerusalem. It's hard to tell how it exactly started. Police claim that Palestinians were throwing objects at them this morning, and they retaliated, but they retaliated very aggressively. And as you said, there was a really high number of injured people today. And this was the most violent day in the Al-Aqsa compound in years. In the afternoon, the Islamist militant group Hamas, which rules over the Gaza Strip, issued an ultimatum to Israel, saying that if by 6 p.m. they didn't remove their forces from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, then they would respond. And sure enough, shortly after 6 p.m. local time, air raid sirens were heard in and around Jerusalem. I heard them myself. I was visiting my parents. According to the Israeli army, 7 rockets were fired from Gaza. One of them directly hit a house in the outskirts of Jerusalem, but there were no casualties.
So rockets targeting Jerusalem from Gaza and hitting one house, I mean, that seems like a big deal.
For years, there's been back and forth rounds of escalation between Israel and Hamas. You know, every few weeks, there's a small round of escalation, every few months, larger, and every few years, pretty much a war. You know, now this is the first time rockets have been fired at Jerusalem since 2014. The Knesset, Israel's parliament that was in session at the time, was actually temporarily evacuated. And I visited the old city today, and I spoke with Yusuf Arar. He's a wedding photographer from East Jerusalem. And he told me that these images of violence in Al-Aqsa are really, really made him burn inside. And this is what he said. What he's saying here is that we're not waiting for anyone to help us. Only God will help us. He says we don't need the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas or any other Arab country. There's God and the armed brigades of Hamas that are looking out for us. That's it.
Let's remember that tensions in Jerusalem did not start today. What was the starting moment for this flashpoint, Ariel?
Jerusalem has always been a source for contention, but it became a tinderbox in recent weeks when the holy month of Ramadan began. At first, Israeli police limited the movement in and out of the centrally placed Damascus Gate. After many nights of clashes between Palestinians and police, Israel then decided to remove the barricades. Another main issue that is really on top of Palestinian minds is looming eviction notices on dozens of Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem. This is a very contentious legal issue. It's seen as the Israeli occupier trying to evict Palestinians from their homes, which is really rallying many, many Palestinians, not only from the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, but also a lot of Arab citizens of Israel are getting involved in this. And it's raising a lot of tension and emotion.
The World's Ariel Osaran speaking with us from Tel Aviv. Thank you very much, Ariel.
Thanks, Marco.
For more on this, we turn to Omar Badar, who's an independent Palestinian-American political analyst based in Washington. How do you see this latest clash, Omar? I mean, we've seen Israeli security forces go after Palestinians in the past. What is different this time from previous confrontations between Israelis and Palestinians?
So what's unfolding on the ground in Jerusalem right now is truly outrageous. And in a way, I mean, not completely unprecedented, but at this point comes at a point of continuous escalation. We're talking about East Jerusalem, which is occupied Palestinian territory. This is universally understood as an area that Israel has no legitimate title to and has no claim to. Nonetheless, Israel has declared that this is its capital. And this is in part due to the Trump administration's endorsement that they feel emboldened to carry on with this mass violence that they're engaging in against unarmed Palestinians. And if this violence were unfolding in the other direction, if it was, you know, armed Palestinians attacking unarmed Israelis in Jewish places of worship, the outrage would just be universal from wall to wall. But unfortunately, right now, the violence that Israel carries out against Palestinians has been normalized to a point where you don't really see adequate outrage in response to what is unfolding today.
So why is this happening now?
So this is a new climate that we're dealing with right now. There is a new level of emboldenment that we see within Israel, and the violence is being carried out clearly in an effort to intimidate Palestinians and drive them out of the city. We see that in the latest escalation in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where multiple Palestinian families are under threat of eviction. And you have this conversation about the Israeli Supreme Court having to weigh in to decide whether these evictions are okay or not.
So the crisis in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, where six Palestinian families are being evicted, I mean, is that separate, or you seem to be indicating that's tied into what's happening today?
That is absolutely tied to what is happening right now. I mean, just that this latest wave of escalation happened precisely on the back of the threat of eviction of Palestinians from the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. This is occupied Palestinian territory. These are Palestinian families living in a Palestinian neighborhood in an area that Israel has no legitimate claim over. And the idea that the Israeli authorities are going to descend into the occupied Palestinian territories to drive Palestinians out of their homes and turn their homes over to Jewish settlers is a war crime. So this is really the backdrop to what we're seeing. And it's just simply a tinderbox right now with an expansion of right-wing politics within Israel and this threat of eviction that is leading us to a situation that could very easily get out of hand. Hundreds of Palestinians injured and scores hospitalized and arrested. And it's not unlikely that there could be an escalation that could lead to death.
The scenes from the Al-Aqsa Mosque are grim, but something does feel different today. What is your hope about what this crisis moment could mean for moving peace forward?
So in a way, Israel's emboldenment to continue to move forward with even more aggressive action against Palestinians is causing a reaction that I think is triggering people's awareness of what is unfolding. And the more awareness there is and the more people are willing to weigh in, as you know, nearly two dozen American lawmakers have, saying that what is unfolding is unacceptable and we need a fundamental change in that relationship and in that reality, the more likely we are to see that there might be a change on the ground. Ultimately, Israel has bucked every effort from the international community to correct its behavior. We've seen a mountain of UN resolutions calling on Israel to end the occupation. It really comes down to the fact that the United States is the only influential patron for Israel because of that $3.8 billion in military aid. So until that relationship is affected, until the United States is willing to place meaningful conditions on that aid, I don't think we're going to see a shift in Israel's behavior. But it looks like we are moving in that direction, that even though we're not quite close enough to it, where we can expect that that change will come in the next year or two, we are beginning to see public discourse on this issue shift in the United States and achieve freedom and equality for everyone living in Palestine and Israel.
Independent Palestinian-American political analyst Omar Badar speaking with us from Washington. Omar, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been a rough school year, a rough school year and a half, if we're counting. Now think about what it's been like if you're trying to learn remotely and in a new language. Across the U.S., an estimated 5 million public school children are considered English language learners. Many of their parents don't speak English, so they're unable to help. Out of this year of educational struggle, though, has emerged a bright spot. The pandemic has pushed many schools to rethink their approach for helping students learning English. The World's Daisy Contreras has a story.
It's 10:30 p.m. when most kids are asleep, but Marcela Alzaga is in front of her laptop. Her mother, Veronica, sits next to her.
A ver, abre inglés.
English?
Mm-hmm. Veronica took the video in September to show how her daughter was studying from home at their dining room table in Rogers, Arkansas, near the Missouri border. Veronica is struggling to figure out how she can help her daughter, who's 12 years old, finish her assignments. It's complicated.
¿Nunca te da la clase el maestro, Marcel? Is it the teachers don't make a video or something?
Not for the classes, no.
No?
No.
All of the classes were self-taught, sort of like standalone webinars, but without any Zoom instruction from teachers. Everything was in English, and Veronica's proficiency is limited. There was no tutoring, no guidance for parents, she says. So she sent Marcela back to in-person learning in October, despite the COVID risks. It was a very hard decision to make, Veronica says today. Children like Marcela are considered English language learners or ELL students. They speak a language other than English at home. Many are born in the U.S. Even before the pandemic, ELL students could face an uphill battle at school with language and cultural barriers. The pandemic just made the academic gap worse, says Cristi Moreno. She's with the National Parents Union, a nationwide network of education advocates. Moreno represents the Midwest.
It's been very challenging, the communications with schools, with teachers. Now layer parents who speak more than one language or who are limited English proficient parents and families.
It's still early to tell just how much the pandemic set behind students like Marcela academically, Moreno says. But as schools return to in-person learning, Moreno wants a reckoning.
My hope is that we do not go back to normal, that we actually learn from our experience throughout this year, and that we become better and that we prepare ourselves, because we should have been already prepared.
But some schools did adapt and saw new ways to help non-English speaking parents, too. Talia Halfen is a community liaison specialist at Kansas City International Academy, an elementary school in Missouri. Once the school set up laptops and Wi-Fi hotspots for students at home, teachers there saw an opportunity to offer parents more resources, like online English classes.
It wasn't even a thought that we would be able to have virtual classes for families where we didn't have to worry about childcare and we didn't have to worry about kind of figuring out what times of days and how we're going to provide transportation for all of these families.
When it came to learning English, some barriers that parents faced in the past were gone. Halfen also did more home visits, far more than she did before the pandemic. She says the visits paid off. She could spot when families who were new to the country needed a hand. For example, she says one family didn't know about changing smoke detector batteries. And so Halfen started carrying spare batteries in her car.
So I think building these relationships has fostered a different type of communication between the school and families in a way that could potentially transform education in a really positive way.
But in Arkansas, Veronica Alzaga, the mom, had a different experience. There wasn't any outreach, at least not in Spanish, to parents like her. No home visits. Without that support, she says, she felt in the dark. So it's a relief to have her daughter back in school, in person.
La vi cambiar completamente, sonreír otra vez.
She's getting better grades, and she smiles more. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Coming up on the show, you think you've been in isolation for a long time? We've got some insects for you that have been in lockdown for 17 years. This summer, they're busting loose and hitting the dating scene hard. We'll explain. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Next month, a meeting will be held by American Catholic bishops. There's speculation that they'll discuss something pretty drastic, denying Holy Communion to President Joe Biden, who is, as you may know, Catholic. More than one conservative bishop has said that Biden's support for abortion rights puts him outside of Catholic doctrine. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, this domestic discussion could have global impacts.
For Catholics, communion is an act of sacred fellowship in which priests bestow the body of Christ in the form of a wafer to congregants. Denying a Catholic communion is a form of punishment and, especially in small communities, public shaming. And that's what those who support abortion deserve, according to San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Corleone. He released a paper and audio recording on the topic last week.
If you find that you are unwilling or unable to abandon your advocacy for abortion, you should not come forward to receive Holy Communion. To publicly affirm the Catholic faith, while at the same time publicly rejecting one of its most fundamental teachings, is simply dishonest.
That's one side of a long-running debate that's heating up now because the U.S. has its second Catholic president. The first one, JFK, was dogged by suspicions that his policies would be influenced by the Vatican. Biden's accused of the opposite. He has worried the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops by lifting restrictions on federal funding for research with fetal tissue and restoring grants to organizations across the globe that perform abortions. The threat of not receiving communion doesn't seem to be holding Biden back. And when a priest denied Biden communion in 2019, he kind of brushed it off.
That's a private matter. I'm not going to talk about that. It's the only time it's ever happened, and we didn't talk about it. He went to the press about it, and it's not a position that I've found anywhere else, including from the Holy Father who gives me communion.
A Pew survey in March found that nearly 70% of U.S. Catholics agree that Biden's stance on abortion shouldn't determine whether he receives communion. But the fact that conservative bishops are debating this may have more of an impact outside the U.S.
I think the point there is how influential the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is globally.
Amanda Usek is International Program Director for the group Catholics for Choice.
The USCCB is one of the most conservative national conferences around the world. What they say influences the lives of people all over the world.
Usek says the group empowers conservative bishops in countries where church and state aren't so firmly separated, where they can talk about politics without risk of losing tax-exempt status.
That deteriorates the separation of church and state. That deteriorates personal morals from public legality. And that's a very serious problem.
Still, there are plenty of places where conservative bishops are losing ground. Women celebrated when Argentina made abortion legal late last year. In 2018, people in Ireland did the same, despite opposition from many church leaders. Sydney Culkin's a lecturer at Queen Mary University of London. She says the church's objections weren't part of the mainstream debate in Ireland about whether to legalize abortion.
The debate, by and large, didn't play out in terms of, you know, what does the Catholic hierarchy think?
Culkin studied how that played out in Ireland compared to the situation in Poland, where the Catholic Church has institutional power and strong political ties. Despite massive protests, Catholic leaders successfully pushed to tighten restrictions on abortion.
Overall, the Catholic Church in Poland has this very, very strong set of anti-abortion preferences, and they have the institutional power to realize those preferences.
Culkin says 98% of the abortions that would have been legal in 1993 are now illegal in Poland. Pope Francis believes women who have abortions can receive communion and be absolved, according to the U.S. Conference of Bishops. Forgiveness has defined Francis's papacy. Catholic bishops would need the Pope's approval if they want to make it official church policy to deny communion to President Biden. Few believe that Francis would go along with that. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
If you aren't hearing it yet, get ready. Trillions of cicadas are starting to emerge above ground in the eastern U.S. Not millions or billions, trillions of these insects, from Indiana to Georgia to New York. They've been waiting for this moment for 17 years, living below ground in the darkness. It's one of the planet's largest broods of periodical cicadas. As the world's Anna Kusma reports, American cicadas do things a bit differently.
The cicadas emerging from the ground this week have missed a lot since they hatched as baby cicadas from eggs 17 years ago. Lady Gaga, Game of Thrones, coronavirus, they've been deep underground for all of it.
They truly are bugs of history in the sense that the eggs that formed the cicadas coming out this year hatched in late July and into August of 2004. George W. Bush is president of the United States.
Gene Kritsky is a cicada expert at Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati. He says the cicadas in the eastern U.S. are unlike those anywhere else in the world.
It's unique to the U.S. is giraffes are to Africa.
These periodic cicadas spend 13 or 17 years maturing underground before they emerge as adults.
They have the longest life cycles of all known insects.
And they emerge all at once in gigantic numbers, creating a huge racket. like in these videos from Maryland and Virginia in 2004, the last time this brood, 10, emerged. Cicadas exist on every continent except Antarctica, but elsewhere they have shorter lifespans and don't emerge in these massive broods. The song is similar, though.
I heard them in Japan, I've heard them in Greece, and in Provence, France, they're a sign of summer.
Why U.S. species act so differently is currently a question mark for scientists. A leading theory is that the long life cycles may have been an adaptation to millions of years of living through North American ice ages, says Kritsky.
Imagine you're in a situation where there's these very cold temperatures north of you. That's 17 years may be highly adapted to survival. It's thought that that long life cycle was an adaptation to life during the ice age.
And many scientists believe that the reason why they come out in such large numbers is to thwart predators like birds.
The predators can eat all they want, and there are still millions of them left.
But the science on all of this is hardly settled, says entomologist John Cooley at the University of Connecticut.
I have to underscore, they are hypotheses. You know, whether they're ever going to move beyond that is an open question because they're kind of hard to test.
Because U.S. cicada populations are so different, it's hard for scientists to do comparative studies that may answer the question of why they're unique. And while humans haven't figured out why U.S. cicadas evolved like they did, it's clearly working for them.
This is clearly a strategy that works. This is one way of accomplishing that goal of grow up, stay alive, find a mate, lay eggs. And this is a really odd way of accomplishing those goals, but it works.
Being loud, raucous, and completely in your face about it, apparently it's the American way. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
You're listening to The World. Sometimes you just need a hug. That's been hard during the pandemic, but in the UK, you'll soon be able to hug again, if you remember how.
We're rusty huggers. We haven't been interacting in that way for so long. And when you interact with someone that way, you don't know what the other person is comfortable with.
How to get our hug back on, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Human rights groups say that Beijing has detained up to 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in camps in northwestern China. The U.S. and the U.K. and Canada have sanctioned China for human rights abuses against the Uyghurs, and now New Zealand is adding its name to the list of critics, determined to see things change in Xinjiang. But as we hear from reporter Ashley Westerman, many leaders in New Zealand feel their country's condemnation falls short.
In 2009, violent clashes between Uyghur protesters and the Chinese military broke out in the Xinjiang capital city of Urumqi. At the time, Shaoud Abdulghafoor was a news cameraman.
It was heartbreaking. I saw so many stuff. Government, how they treated Uyghurs. It's the same as the animal.
He ended up filming some things that got published by foreign media, and the Chinese government didn't like it. So he got a call from Beijing. Luckily, he was in New Zealand going to school when he got it. They knew he had filmed the tape and wanted him to come back to China immediately.
I refused and then applied for the asylum seeker.
But the nightmare wasn't over. His Uyghur family was still in their hometown of Kashgar, including his mother.
April 2016, she called me, never called her again. After that, I lost contact.
His mother and three brothers were taken to internment camps. Human rights activists say forced labor, re-education, and even the sterilization of Uyghur women happened there. China denies the accusations of abuse, insisting that the massive vocational and training camps are necessary to combat terrorism and poverty. Abdulghafoor's 80-year-old mother and two of his brothers were finally released in 2020, but it's still dangerous for him to talk to them.
I really miss my family. I just want to hear my mom's voice. What did she eat for breakfast, or lunch, even?
Which is why Abdulghafoor, who now lives and works in Auckland, was disappointed in the recent vote held in the New Zealand Parliament concerning China's alleged abuses.
New Zealand can do more, but they didn't. They refused to say a genocide.
The word genocide was actually included in Member of Parliament Brooke Van Velden's proposal on the issue, but it was ultimately stripped out. Here's Van Velden on the floor last Wednesday.
It's important for people to know how we got to debating the motion before us today. I started with the same motion as the British, then had to dilute it and soften it to gain the approval of New Zealand's governing party.
That would be Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's Labour Party. The motion ultimately passed, but with the phrase severe human rights abuses in place of the word genocide.
It essentially was watered down.
Jeffrey Miller is with the Wellington-based think tank Democracy Project. He says New Zealand has noticeably taken a softer stance against China compared to the rest of the Five Eyes alliance, which also includes Australia, Canada, the UK, and the US.
New Zealand is trying to straddle a middle ground between these two big power blocks, and New Zealand is just so heavily dependent on trade with China and is very, very vulnerable.
China is by far New Zealand's number one trading partner, with two-way trade exceeding $24 billion U.S. dollars, according to government figures. And pre-pandemic, 11% of New Zealand's tourists came from China. After the motion was passed, the Chinese embassy in Wellington lashed out at what it called groundless accusations.
The real question is whether they take any action.
Like the actions they've taken against Australia, Miller says, Beijing and Canberra have been locked in an economic tit-for-tat since 2018. As a result, trade is down between the two. China is also Australia's largest trading partner.
So New Zealand looks on and sees what has happened to Australia and, you know, worries that the same thing could happen to it.
New Zealand Foreign Minister Nanaina Mahuta has defended the decision not to use the word. She told Reuters that her government didn't think the situation in Xinjiang constituted as genocide. Sophie Richardson, China director at Human Rights Watch, says governments are just reluctant to use that word.
Because it is hard to do business as usual with the government you have accused of doing that. It's sort of further complicated by the reality that in principle, using that term can trigger certain kinds of legal obligations, but very few people have actually been prosecuted on charges of genocide.
Still, Richardson says the passage of the motion is meaningful, as New Zealand joins over 40 countries around the world to make similar statements. She hopes the momentum will mobilize the United Nations to call for an international investigation. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Manila.
Starting next Monday, England will be easing lockdown measures. That means hugs are back. Here's British Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking earlier today at a press conference in London.
We're updating the guidance on close contact between friends and family, setting out the risks for everyone to make their own choices.
It may seem like a small thing, but health experts say hugs and human touch are important for social, psychological, and biological benefits. Kimberly Dinas is a lecturer in clinical and health psychology at Swansea University in the UK. She joins us now. Why are hugs and touch important to people, to humans? What's a scientific explanation, Kimberly?
Hugs are important to us for our emotions. I think everybody knows that. They make you feel good. But what a lot of people don't know is that hugs are also important for our biology, for us physically. As early as the moment after birth, touch is something that can actually reduce pain. It's something that increases hormones that help you bond to your mom. And it's something that later on in life both increases immunity, so it increases your ability to fight off disease, and it reduces your stress levels.
I mean, I get the reduction of stress. I feel that when I have been getting a hug just in the last 12 months. But how does touch increase immunity?
It's actually linked to the stress system. So with stress reduction, it actually reduces your cortisol levels, right? Cortisol is a stress hormone. And with immunity, what it can actually do is increase your ability to fight off inflammation. So it will increase your inflammatory markers that will help you fight off infection.
I have a dog, speaking of hugs, and he's not getting one right now, but somebody's coming back to the house, so hang on just a second. I'm sorry about this.
Petting a dog can help too.
Exactly. Okay. So for many people during the pandemic, it's meant fewer hugs or no hugs at all. What has that actually done to our psyche? Have you noticed any effects on people after a year of this?
It's interesting that you say this. We've actually been speaking to the same group of people since March 23rd, so the very beginning of the pandemic. And one thing that we've seen is that the people that are the most isolated have been hardest hit, have felt the greatest amount of loss. And that loss of social contact is something that they bring up over and over again. It comes down to something quite simple. I just want a hug. Mm. You know, I just want that social contact. And it's really been emotionally very difficult for them. Depression, anxiety levels have been a lot higher for those who are alone.
And I don't know if you've been able to witness this over the past year, Kimberly, but when somebody has not been hugged for a while and they do get one, what happens?
That's something that we haven't really been able to assess quite yet. We're just getting there. But I know that things that I've heard from people colloquially at this point is that it's almost unnerving. One thing that we've been talking about is how people are rusty huggers. We just haven't done it for so long. But we're rusty huggers. We haven't been interacting in that way for so long. And when you interact with someone that way, you don't know what the other person is comfortable with. So I think being comfortable again is something that's going to take a while, but it's something that's very important.
So let me be the voice of people who just don't like hugging, because face it, hugs can be awkward for some people. Have you heard anyone say, finally a world where I don't have to hug anybody? And what is your reaction to that?
It's funny you should mention that. I actually spoke to a couple of radio announcers here in the UK who said, you know, I just don't like hugging. You know, it's going to be fine for me. And I absolutely think that there are people who are not going to need to hug people. At the same time, the ability to shake hands, to have kind of a normative social touch is something that's important for people, even if they're not going to, you know, reach on and give them a big old hug when they meet somebody for the first time.
Kimberly, are you a hugger?
I'm a hugger. Yeah. I'm one of those people that's just like, hey, come here, give me a hug. Yes, so that is true. But my husband, who is Welsh and is a hugger with close others, but definitely not with people that he meets.
Oh, interesting. The nuances of hugging. Aside from people who are already in your bubble, like your husband, are there people you've really missed hugging?
Oh, my friends. So my closest friends, I actually got to go see up north this past weekend, and kind of trying to keep along with the regulations, but still be able to be close to my close others was very difficult. I'm really looking forward to having these regulations lifted.
Well, something tells me your hugging hasn't gotten too rusty.
It's possible, but I definitely don't walk up to people in the street and do it, nor would I do it when sick. So it is a balance between risk and hugging.
Most definitely. Kimberly Dana is a lecturer in clinical and health psychology at Swansea University in the UK. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's been really great to talk to you.
Viktor Orbán's reputation as the Prime Minister of Hungary is that of an authoritarian, and he's only become more so over the years. Orbán and his far-right party, Fidesz, have been chiseling away at the fundamentals of Hungarian civil society since they gained power in 2010.
They have essentially seized control over every major institution in society.
That's Matt Steinglass, European correspondent at The Economist. He was on a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Steinglass was talking about Orbán's most recent move, seizing control of Hungary's universities.
They already had control of government, obviously, the electoral system, the courts, the media. And this means that they're now in control of higher education as well.
Like many of Orbán's moves, the university scheme was pulled off as part of a reform that's clearly not democratic. As Matt explains, universities are now in the control of public foundations, along with billions of dollars worth of assets.
The government has done something which is characteristic of Orbán and of Fidesz, which is to take control of the legal niceties of reform processes in order to subtly give itself tremendous power. So the boards of trustees of these foundations are now going to be appointed initially just by the government, with no power of veto or influence for any other bodies, including the universities themselves. And the members of those boards can serve until the age of 80. When one of them dies or retires, their replacement will be appointed by the board itself. So essentially, control has been turned over to these guys, possibly in perpetuity.
The fear now is that Hungary's universities will simply become mouthpieces for the government. Critics say Prime Minister Orbán's vision of a so-called illiberal democracy has influenced other countries, like Poland. Now they're quickly backsliding away from democracy toward authoritarian populism. In other European countries, leaders have been trying to stop that. After all, Hungary is a member of the European Union and must abide by EU statutes. The EU Commission has been reluctant to come down hard on Hungary, but the economist Matt Steinglass says that if a European country abuses a new EU guideline around the rule of law, there can be consequences.
Because Hungary is abusing the rule of law in academia, any academic aid that it's receiving as part of European spending in general or as part of the new big European recovery fund for the aftermath of the COVID crisis could be cut off.
The most recent move by Orbán may be that bridge too far if Europeans are willing to take action.
One thing that's really missing here is a lot more anger from citizens of other European countries about what's going on in Hungary. Hungary is a member of the European Union, which is supposed to be a club of liberal democracies, and it is perverting the structure of liberal democracy, and it's being subsidized by the EU to do so. Hungary was the biggest beneficiary of EU funding from 2014 to 20. European citizens have got to be a lot more angry about this. Their taxpayer dollars are being sent to a country whose government uses them for corruption on an extraordinary scale. And Europe has the power to stop that. It will do that if European voters get angry enough about it.
That's Matt Steinglass, European correspondent at The Economist, shared with us by our partners at Economist Radio. In Afghanistan, it's been a month now since the U.S. announced its final withdrawal of troops. In that time, attacks launched by the Taliban have only grown more frequent and brazen. Afghans have been living in a daily state of terror. On Saturday, a triple bombing at a girls' school in Kabul killed at least 60 people. Most were students between the ages of 11 and 15. Today, a roadside bomb blew up a bus in a southern province of the country. At least 11 people killed in that incident. Ali Dosti is a 24-year-old student at the American University of Afghanistan. His sisters were at a school in the neighborhood where the bomb exploded Saturday.
I saw mothers who were searching, who were looking for the address of the hospitals. They were walking. They didn't have any money to take a car to get to the hospital their children were brought in. So they were just walking, running, and looking for addresses, stopping people to ask for the names of the hospital. Where is this hospital? I was heading to home with a dear friend of mine who his sisters were not yet returned home. And we got so much worried and concerned. So what we did, we stopped by every single hospital nearby the place that attack happened. And every single hospital was full of people who were crying. We saw a lot of wounded young girl students were brought in.
That experience of going from hospital to hospital and seeing those families with their daughters looking for their children, it just sounds traumatizing. Has your friend been able to find his loved ones?
Yeah, when we were stopping by different hospitals at the end of the day, we received this call that his sisters are back home safely. They managed to escape the school, and we got so happy.
This high school, Ali, Syed Ul Shuhada, it's got instruction for boys, I understand, in the morning and for girls in the afternoon. Now, this attack happened at 4 p.m. as the girls were leaving and the streets were packed with people preparing for the end of the holy month of Ramadan. How significant is it that this attack appears to have targeted girls?
The school is located in a very impoverished area, and the families there, they hardly make a living, but they strive always to send their children to school. But the terrorist groups, they don't want girls to get educated. They see this as a threat to themselves. That's why they are being targeted over and over.
Do you think your sisters will go back to school after what they've been through?
My sisters will go back. That's our only weapon. We know that we have to rise again. We have to continue educating ourselves. We have to continue and strive for our education. We are sharing this message to the terrorist groups that you might be silencing us, but you cannot silence our hopes. You cannot silence our will towards education, because what is the means for our thriving and surviving? That's, of course, education.
How do you feel about the American military leaving in a few months' time?
Well, when American troops came to Afghanistan, they legitimized their intention to come to Afghanistan with this savior message to protect women of Afghanistan. But now that they are leaving, we see that they have failed to that mission to save the Afghan women. Now we see that all across Afghanistan, day in, day out, people are being killed. Women are being killed for no reason. And this is what exactly the U.S. is doing. They are leaving behind in this critical time. They are leaving us behind in this time of violence, in this time of horror.
Ali Dosti is a student at the American University of Afghanistan. His sisters were at a Kabul school in the neighborhood where a bomb exploded this weekend. Gratefully, his sisters are alive. As risky as migration is on flimsy lifeboats, people will do it because not migrating for many of them is even riskier. So far this year, according to the United Nations, more than 600 people have died or gone missing in the Mediterranean Sea on these voyages, and that's more than twice the number from last year. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi has more.
On Sunday, May 2nd, a wooden boat carrying migrants en route to Europe became stranded off the coast of Libya. Their engine had broken down and a storm was coming. So migrants on the boat called an emergency hotline called Alarm Phone. It's an organization that helps migrants in distress on the Mediterranean Sea. Diana Dadusk was on duty that day. She's an Alarm Phone volunteer, and she spoke with the migrants in Italian.
They were saying they were dying. They were saying that they needed something to support them, even if it was not to rescue them, but at least not to let them die. They were saying that the sea was really big, that the waves were high, and that the boat was really small.
They told Dadusk that most of them were Egyptians. Some had been deported from Italy, which is how they had learned Italian. Now they were trying to reach Europe again. Dadusk stayed on with them for hours as the storm approached. Her office made calls to European and Libyan authorities. Flight data shows a Frontex, the European Border Agency, plane circled nearby.
Only in one moment, when I found out that a merchant vessel was going there, I could reassure them and say, rescue's coming. The merchant vessels are arriving. They're going to be there for you. You're not going to be alone anymore. And then the merchant vessels didn't rescue.
Instead, those merchant vessels waited nearby for the Libyan Coast Guard to arrive. Then, according to the UN, around 95 people were returned to a detention center in Libya. Dadusk says this was a classic example of the pushback policies that are endangering migrants.
Both Italy and Malta say, oh, they're not in Europe, so it's not our responsibility. So if we're pushing them back, well, it's not really a pushback. It's still a Libyan responsibility, but in fact, that's international waters.
The ramifications can be deadly. That same weekend, 11 people drowned in a shipwreck, according to the UN. Safa Mesheli is a spokeswoman with the International Office for Migration.
People crossing these dangerous waters need assistance and need search and rescue capacity in order to reduce loss of life.
She says that governments need to be the ones coordinating search and rescue. Instead, it's overstretched NGOs like Alarm Phone that are doing their best in a huge sea. Mesheli says European countries need to be realistic about migration. It's not slowing down. In fact, during the pandemic, migration along some routes from Western and North Africa to Europe had actually increased.
People will continue to take these difficult journeys as long as there are no legal routes and legal pathways and protection for them from the impact of smugglers and the influence of trafficking groups.
The UN says approximately 7,000 migrants have been intercepted on boats and returned to Libya this year. The conditions for migrants there are bad, says Mohammed, a Sudanese migrant in Libya. He asked to remain anonymous because he's afraid of Libyan smugglers and the authorities.
Libyan, they use discrimination against the black people. There's no government here. You're working without money. They use them to kill Africans. Then we have no choice.
No choice but to try to make the journey to Europe is what he means. While Libya does have a new interim government now, the UN says it's no place for refugees or migrants. Mohammed says he wants to make his second attempt to cross the Mediterranean as soon as he can, even though he knows many migrants who have drowned trying.
I'm still working here to find enough money to cross the sea. But most of my friends who were with me at home, they drowned in the sea 2018, 2019, even last 2 weeks ago. My friends are 16 of them, they are drowned in the sea.
In that one incident, more than 130 migrants lost their lives. Mohammed says in some ways that's better than being returned to Libya. On his first attempt to cross the Mediterranean a few years ago, he says his boat was intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard.
All of us tried to jump in the sea. Most of us preferred to die in the sea in order to come back to Libya. All of us were angry. We don't know. We have no choice. Yeah.
The UN is calling on Libya to close its migrant detention centers. Even children are being detained there, says Abdelkadir Moussa. He's with the UNICEF office in Tripoli.
More children are also being intercepted and returned to Libya since the beginning of 2021. And most of these children are brought to detention centers upon disembarkation in Libya.
In fact, 2 weeks ago, 125 mostly unaccompanied children were intercepted en route to Europe and returned to Libya. Many end up in crowded detention centers, stuck with adults, with limited access to food and water. There's an estimated 65,000 migrant and refugee children currently in Libya.
We would like to see European countries addressing the urgent needs of these migrants and vulnerable women and children. Return to Libya is not in the best interest of the child migrants and refugees.
Moussa says the situation could get even worse in the next few months. In the summer, the tides will be low, and once again, more migrants are expected to try crossing the Mediterranean. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Hey, podcast listeners. As Muslims all over the world get ready to celebrate Eid al-Fitr and the end of Ramadan, we want to know how you'll be celebrating Eid this year. Please share your traditions and inspirations with us, special dishes, gifts, or reflections on what this time means for you. Email us at myworld@theworld.org with a voice memo that has your message, your name, and location, and how you listen to The World. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. We might feature you on the show. We're waiting to hear from you. Thanks very much. How about ending things today with a little taste of Wales? Because let's face it, the day is always better with a little Tom Jones in it, and the Welsh soul rocker, who is 80, has just come out with a new album. It's called Surrounded by Time and debuted at number one in the UK with tunes like this.
I got myself an obsession. It's on another dimension. Don't need a whole lot of protection. Cause it gave me all I've been getting. It gave me life, hope, dreams, goals. You know, whoa, you've got to give a little love. Give a little love. Go on, just do it. You can't abuse it. Give a little love.
Leaving you today with new music from Tom Jones. Give a little love. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong, and thanks for listening.